It's Tuesday, March 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the fragile ceasefire holds in Syria, new threats to Africa and Europe from Islamic State in Libya. It will be Super Tuesday only for a few U.S. presidential hopefuls.
I'd like to, for the legacy of this flight to be that we can decide to do hard things and hard things that'll take us further away from the Earth.
It's time to come home from a year in space. Also ahead, Hollywood's biggest night, the Oscars. It's all on today's International Edition. Despite an exchange of accusations of violations, the U.S.-Russian negotiated ceasefire across Syria continues to hold, except for areas controlled by the Islamic State of the al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front. The Pentagon said U.S.-led coalition airstrikes continued Sunday with 12 sorties against suspected IS targets in Syria. Meanwhile, the main opposition High Negotiations Committee complained to the U.N. of numerous violations by Damascus and its allies. Nevertheless, the UN and its partner aid organizations are planning to use the lull in fighting to provide life-saving assistance to tens of thousands of Syrians trapped by years of war. On Friday, U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner described the cessation of hostilities as an important moment.
It's an opportunity, to put it mildly, for all the parties to step up and to do what they must do to stop the violence and bloodshed in Syria and truly press for an end to this conflict, which has cost so many lives and so much suffering, via a political transition in accordance with the Geneva Communique 2012. Without obviously giving a list or going through a list of names, I would just say the vast majority of Syrian armed opposition groups have told the U.S. That they have accepted the terms for the cessation of hostilities. And as I said, many of these groups have made this confirmation either directly to us or through the HNC.
But he declined to provide the number of opposition groups involved or give a list of names for security reasons. Toner said the Cessation of Hostilities Task Force will investigate violations and adjudicate them. A senior U.S. official is quoted as saying setbacks are inevitable, adding the U.S. does not expect the violence to end immediately. Regional analyst Amin Saikal of the Australian National University tells VOA's Victor Beattie he is surprised the ceasefire is holding, but time will tell if it would lead to a resumption of peace talks.
We will now really have to watch how the ceasefire is going to be translated into something long-term, which could really open the way for negotiations between the Assad regime and opposition forces. But let's not really forget that the Russians and, of course, the U.S.-led international coalition will still continue their fight against Islamic State and the Jabhat al-Nusra. So I think the fighting is still really going on in the north of Syria, and the latest report also suggested that the Islamic State has made some advances against the Kurds in that area.
Is that a big concern that radical groups like al-Nusra and the Islamic State will take advantage of this ceasefire?
Well, as far as they're concerned, there is no ceasefire because the declaration of the ceasefire on the part of the United States and Russia really exclude the Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State. The fight there will really basically continue, and the Jabhat al-Nusra and, for that matter, Islamic State feel under no obligation to observe any ceasefire.
Have the Russian-backed Syrian forces made all the gains they want in and around Aleppo, or do you expect more fighting?
I think there is going to be more fighting, and the Russians will carry out their air operations, although President Obama has made it quite clear that all air operations will stop. But at the same time, as long as the fight against Jabhat al-Nusra and so-called Islamic State continue, then one could not really exclude further air operations on the part of Russia and the Assad Air Force.
UN Special Envoy to Syria, Stefan de Mistura, has called for a new round of indirect peace talks in Geneva March 7. How likely will that be to get underway?
I think if this ceasefire holds, then there is a good possibility that the negotiation will resume. And again, it may not be face-to-face negotiations. It may be indirect negotiations. But nonetheless, I think that is something that would need to be welcomed, not only by the Syrian people who are very desperate for the longer period of peace and stability, but also by the international community. But I think we will have to really wait and see how the situation is going to evolve from here, and whether these negotiations will start, and if they do start, whether they are going to really drag on for a long time. One could not really expect that there is going to be a respite in immediate terms, but let's hope that in medium to long run, it will produce the desirable results.
Amin Saikal says if humanitarian convoys are allowed to reach civilians and Russia halts attacks on civilian targets, the opposition will come under enormous pressure to engage in serious peace talks to end the conflict. The fighting in Syria has not only sent millions of people seeking refuge across Europe and elsewhere, but the campaigns against Islamic State insurgents has forced many of those fighters to flee the country and regroup elsewhere. Northern Africa has seen a huge growth in Islamic State activity, especially in Libya, where it is believed that IS fighters can easily move into Europe or spread into other parts of Africa. We're joined from Beirut, Lebanon, by Alessandria Masi, Middle East correspondent for International Business Times, to help assess this growing threat. Alessandria, what is the current level of Islamic State activity in Libya?
ISIS right now is estimated to be about 6,000 fighters strong in Libya, and the majority of those fighters are not Libyan. I would say roughly 300 to 600 are Libyan. So most of them are foreign fighters, and those are both new recruits that are coming in from other countries in North Africa and also Europe, and fighters who have already been in Iraq and Syria who have now left. The fact that they've left, that's a major result of the Russian airstrikes that started in Syria in October.
Is Libya becoming the focal point for these people leaving the Syria region?
It is not becoming a focal point in that they're giving up on Syria, but what it is becoming is the main hub for ISIS in North Africa. Libya really is the doorstep to the rest of North Africa and Africa as a whole. It also puts them right below Europe, which they recognize and they know they can use to their advantage.
Speaking of Europe, I would think access from Syria north might be easier. Why is it easier for them to access Europe from Libya?
Because of the huge amount of migrants that leave from Libya and go to southern Europe, so Italy particularly. There are a lot of boats that go back and forth. I think last year the number was over 150,000 migrants who left from Libya to go to southern Europe. So that is a route that they can definitely use. With Syria now, I mean, the focus is on Iraq and Syria, and so the borders are much more watched than they are in Libya. For Libya, the threat also, of course, is fighters going home. A lot of European fighters who were in Iraq and Syria can use the pathway from Iraq or Syria to Libya to make it back to Europe to carry out attacks, and I think that's a big threat. It's something we've been worried about since the beginning of ISIS, and now it's much easier for them to do from Libya.
Since the fall of Muammar Gaddafi, how has the situation in Libya been? We understand it's rather chaotic. It appears that this provides a pretty good atmosphere for ISIS to exist.
Yeah, Libya actually has kind of a perfect atmosphere for ISIS to thrive in. It's fairly lawless, and right now there are two governments that are vying for power of Libya. There's also a unity government that's based in Tunisia. It's a third government that's hoping to group the other two together but hasn't yet. In addition to that, there are dozens of different militias on the ground who have no political affiliation, and they're the ones with the power. So laws don't really exist too much in Libya at the moment, and there's also a large amount of weapons that ISIS has been able to take advantage of in Libya, left over from Muammar Gaddafi's regime.
What about the rest of Africa? How does their position in Libya perhaps threaten other areas in Africa and link up with other groups? We know Boko Haram is a particularly horrific group.
Boko Haram is an ISIS affiliate right now, but to the extent where they receive weapons or even training from ISIS leadership in Iraq and Syria, it's still very unclear. We do know that ISIS in Libya does receive training and weapons and also fighters from ISIS leadership in Iraq and Syria. Right now, the biggest threat is to Tunisia, and that's because their border is very long and also has not been protected for a very long time. the area between the Tunisia and Libya border has had militant training camps for years. They weren't just ISIS ones, but now we know that at least one or two of them have been taken by ISIS.
Alessandra Masi is a correspondent for International Business Times based in Beirut, Lebanon. Check out her article online. Biggest ISIS threat to Europe now comes from Libya, not Syria and Iraq. Alessandra, thanks so much for taking time to join us today.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information. For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. The so-called Super Tuesday presidential primaries are upon U.S. voters when several large states select their candidates for the respective nominations of the Republican and Democrat parties. The eventual nominees will face off in the November general elections to become the next U.S. president. Billionaire real estate developer Donald Trump leads among the Republicans, while former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and of course wife of former President Bill Clinton, leads in the Democrats' race. Some of the key issues to watch have been posted on our website, voanews.com, such as, will Republican Ted Cruz win his home state of Texas? If he doesn't, is he out? Who wins Massachusetts, Minnesota, and Vermont for the Republicans? It will be a barometer of Donald Trump's support in northern states and the measure of the impact of his latest controversy regarding the white supremacy group Ku Klux Klan. Can Democrat Bernie Sanders attract votes among African Americans? African American voters have a large impact on Democratic primaries in southern states. How well does Hillary Clinton do with young white voters? Sanders has been strong in that demographic and could win Colorado, Minnesota, and Massachusetts. Go to our website and check out more. One question, though, that's not being asked at this point is one that I posed to VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone just a short time ago. Quite often in these campaigns, somebody who's doing pretty well behind the front runner could be considered a vice presidential component on the ticket in November. It's kind of hard to really figure out Donald Trump if he would actually go with somebody who's popular like Rubio or pick somebody else.
That's a very good question because he has been unorthodox in all his other decisions and in the way he's gone about his campaign. So it might not be a great idea to put a lot of stock in the traditional format for doing that. I do think a lot of people, though, are looking at Rubio as someone who certainly could be a potential vice presidential pick with his appeal to younger voters, to minority voters, especially Hispanics. That'll be a crucial part of the election coming up. So Rubio's in that mix. The problem there is if they do wind up really going at each other one-on-one before the end of the primaries, will some untold damage be done? This happened with South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to an extent. I think she and the relationship with Trump is not great because there were some attacks there.
Very quickly, among the Democrats, we've got Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, Hillary winning again in her latest primary. And it would appear that Hillary is gaining some momentum. I doubt we're going to see Bernie on that ticket.
Yeah, that's probably right at this point. The race is starting to swing south in South Carolina and then in the Super Tuesday states, many southern states. Lots of African-American voters in the Democratic ranks, and that is probably going to help Clinton. Down the road, some of the Midwest states may be more favorable to Sanders. So that race could go on for a while.
And there's some question about the number of delegates that she would take into the convention where she could possibly win most of the states, except for maybe up in the Northeast like Vermont, but still not have enough delegates to clinch the nomination.
And one of the reasons for that is in the Democratic Party formulation, it's basically proportional delegate awards all the way through the primary season. with the Republicans, once you hit March 15th, particularly with big states like Florida and Ohio, it begins to look turn into a winner-take-all. So that's why they've devised that system. They want to sort of ramp up a nominee and not have it drag on. They want that person to get there. This time it may have unintended consequences, though, if that nominee is Donald Trump.
Always running on an uncontested ticket is our own Jim Malone. VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Up next, our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is in the studio to talk about online reaction to this important day of voting. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Let's begin with Donald Trump, since he's dominating the polls nationwide.
Sure. Trump received his first Senate endorsement Sunday from Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, but on Monday, another Republican senator, Ben Sasse from Nebraska, said he will not support Trump. He shared an open letter to Trump supporters on Facebook.
Well, what did he write?
It's quite long, but he did say he hopes the party selects one of the other GOP candidates. He added if Donald Trump ends up as the GOP nominee, conservatives will need to find a third option. He also wrote, Mr. Trump's relentless focus is on dividing Americans and tearing down rather than building back up this glorious nation.
He is saying Trump is not about making America great again, his slogan. What about the controversy surrounding white supremacist groups, former leader David Duke? What's the latest on that?
So Trump appeared on television Monday and said he didn't get to disavow former Ku Klux Klan leader the day before because he couldn't hear very well. He blamed a faulty earpiece, and here's what he said verbatim. I am sitting in a house in Florida with a very bad earpiece that they gave me, and you can hardly hear what he was saying. During Sunday's interview with CNN, Trump did not criticize a white supremacist group or its leader, even though he was given the opportunity many times.
Okay, well, let's move on to the Democrats. What are they saying?
Hillary Clinton tweeted an image that said, I believe in love and kindness. Now, this is very much in line with what many people have urged her to do to be more personable. But the replies to that tweet were rather interesting, this time judging her for being too fluffy. One user asked sarcastically, I wonder if she believes in babies and puppies. Hashtag mindless rhetoric. Her rival Bernie Sanders received some good news. Colorado Senator Michael Merrifield endorsed Sanders and tweeted, Proud to support Bernie, hashtag Super Monday. Sanders retweeted that. That's all for me today. Jim?
Well, thanks for the analysis, G, and you can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee. I post several times daily as well at VOA Stevenson, and the International Edition stream may be found at VOA_IE. Barclays Africa Group shares slid almost 7% on Monday as speculation is mounting that Barclays could be withdrawing or seriously downsizing from Africa. On Sunday, its board was evaluating strategic options for its 62.3% or $8.3 billion stake in the business. Details about its plans are expected later today when Barclays reports full year results. The first International Space Station crew to spend almost a year in space returns to Earth later today. U.S. astronaut Scott Kelly, who together with Russian cosmonaut Mikhail Kornienko participated in the most comprehensive study so far of long-time living in zero gravity, and they gave Earthbound reporters insight into their experiences. VOA's George Pudich shares with us what Kelly said.
Levitating gently in the middle of a room whose walls were covered with equipment, cables, scientific instruments, and several high-end cameras with extremely long lenses, Scott Kelly talked about his life on board the International Space Station and the prospects of much longer space missions.
I'd like to, for the legacy of this flight to be that we can decide to do hard things and hard things that'll take us further away from the Earth, and this is one of them. And, you know, I'm hopeful, and I think we'll learn a lot about longer duration space flight and how that will take us to Mars someday.
Talking about everyday life, Kelly said the most difficult aspects of living in space are the fact that everything floats and the lack of running water. Not surprisingly, he said that the first thing he wants to do when he gets back home is to jump in his pool. The astronaut said that physically he feels very good, but admitted that it might be a subjective impression. Asked about psychological difficulties, Kelly said the only thing he really missed was physical contact with his family.
I don't know if I'd necessarily call it the psychological aspect, but there's certainly, you know, a loss of connection with folks on the ground that you care for and love and, you know, want to spend time with, that I think is a challenge.
The purpose of this year-long experiment was collecting data that would help astronauts prepare for deep space missions, such as a visit to Mars. When Kelly returns to Earth, scientists will compare his physical data to that of his twin brother, now retired NASA astronaut Mark Kelly, looking for subtle effects and changes. Kelly said one of his conclusions at the end of this mission is that living space on a long-term mission spacecraft will have to be much better designed.
On a trip to Mars, we're not going to have this much space, obviously. You're going to be in much tighter quarters. You're going to, you know, you're going to live, you're going to use the restroom, you're going to exercise, all within, you know, a few square meters of one another, I assume. You know, that's probably, you know, it's not going to be like the science fiction spaceship going to Mars.
Kelly says he thinks a trip to Mars is possible in the near future.
After being here for so long, that's one thing I definitely realize, that, you know, if we can dream it, you know, we can do it if we really want to.
Scott Kelly and his Russian counterpart, Mikhail Kornienko, are scheduled to land at Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
And we look forward to their safe return later today. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Movie fans were able to watch their favorite stars all together at the annual Academy Awards ceremony in Los Angeles. The Oscars didn't do so well on television. It had its lowest estimated viewership in the United States since 2008. But still, a lot of buzz was around the winners and some of the controversy, as we hear more from International Business Times reporter Matthew Pressburg, who joins us from Los Angeles.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, the Academy Awards, the big takeaway is that, you know, diversity was the big issue. Ever since nominations were announced January 14th, the whole conversation's been about diversity. It's been about two straight years of all-white nominees in the acting categories. And with Chris Rock as the host, he was always going to address that early on. And his monologue was probably the highlight of the show. It was powerful. It was right to the point. It was funny. Some people thought he didn't hit the mark head-on. He shied away from some of the controversial issues. But I think, you know, got a response. The crowd was excited. You know, people reacted to it. But the show kind of got away a little bit. Lady Gaga and the Vice President Joe Biden had a very powerful sexual assault presentation. But then we had sort of other pet issues come up. We had the director of The Big Short talking about, you know, how people shouldn't vote for somebody who takes money from Wall Street. We had Leonardo DiCaprio giving a big speech about climate change, which has been a pretty big conversation in Hollywood for, you know, 15, 20 years now. Very important issue, but it did seem like Chris Rock's powerful political message may have got away from him over the course of a show that ran about 4 hours.
The discussion about diversity included the groups that weren't being discussed. It was primarily about African Americans not being in the Oscars this year, but there were also discussions about Asians and others who also were not included.
And what was interesting was Chris Rock, one of his, you know, lowlights of the evening was when he made a joke about Asian children and accounting. It really didn't land, and it created kind of a furor on social media. Where in the diversity Oscars, you know, an anti-Asian joke, I guess, was kind of the lowlight of the evening. So, you know, it really was. The Asian actors, the lack thereof, became a topic of conversation, and largely because of that joke.
And it was a huge evening for the Oscars on social media.
Oh, yeah. And not a great evening for the Oscars and the television ratings, but in social media, the conversation keeps getting bigger year after year. And especially with the political issues and with, the, you know, a wide-open award ceremony where Spotlight and Underdog won Best Picture. Yeah, it really did spark a lot of social media conversation.
Leonardo DiCaprio finally got his Oscar for Best Actor. I almost envision him going up on stage and just holding his hands out and saying, "I'm on top of the world," and walking off the stage.
Right. I mean, it was a long time coming, and people were joking that maybe the climate change speech was in his back pocket for 10 years, and he was always going to give it when he was the Best Actor. But yeah, I mean, he was the overwhelming betting favorite on this. Everybody kind of thought it was coming, the sentimental favorite. There weren't tons of memorable performances opposite him. Leo was kind of, it was always going to be his coronation. Nobody was really surprised he won. A lot of people are happy for him, but I guess if this is the toughest thing he's had to go through in his career, we should all be so lucky.
And of course, and we mentioned Spotlight. Those of us who are in the media and journalists were rather partial to that film.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, journalists love the fact that Spotlight won, but then again, we are journalists.
It was a bit of a surprise for that, because I think a lot of people were thinking, well, you know, maybe The Revenant would come out at the end.
Yeah, it was. A lot of people thought The Revenant, you know, would kind of complete the Triple Crown, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Picture, but no, it was Spotlight. But also this year, what was kind of interesting to me was that, you know, 10 Best Picture nominees, but if you think back at 2015 in film, Star Wars, Jurassic World, Furious 7, and to a lesser extent, Creed and Straight Outta Compton were huge, popular hits. And if you watch the award ceremony, they really, you know, it was as if they weren't even released. And so there weren't a lot of big fan favorite movies in that Best Picture category. Mad Max was probably the most popular award-winning choice by the general movie audience. But yeah, I mean, so it kind of did create that opportunity for an underdog film like Spotlight to go and take that trophy.
Well, we hand the Oscar for Best Reporting following the ceremony to International Business Times entertainment reporter Matthew Pressburg. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Our award for Best Director goes to Tracy Carter. Best Engineer is Chaz Hall. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. The best audience, no doubt, is you. Thanks for joining us. We're on Facebook and Twitter. We'll see you there as well. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Coca-Cola Company have announced support for a new program in Nigeria under the Water and Development Alliance, also known as the WADA Project. The $2 million project will provide up to 100,000 citizens in Cross River State with access to safe drinking water and good sanitation facilities by 2019. This joint investment is aligned with USAID and Coca-Cola's shared focus on clean water provision as a means to help build healthy, sustainable communities in Nigeria. The U.S. government is committed to engaging in effective and innovative alliances with committed partners to support Nigeria's critical development needs, said William Stoyer, acting U.S. Consul General in Lagos. We are proud to collaborate with Coca-Cola to bring a sustainable and safe water solution to thousands of people in Nigeria, he added. During the signing event, USAID Mission Director to Nigeria, Michael Harvey, said, "Today we are consolidating a special partnership, one in which a private firm has joined with a U.S. government agency to contribute to a priority set by the government of Nigeria." USAID and Coca-Cola have collaborated in Nigeria since 2007. The partnership has improved water resource management and expanded sustainable access to safe drinking water and sanitation services in Kano and in Yugu states. The WADA project helps to control and prevent water-related diseases such as cholera, typhoid, and diarrhea by providing water and sanitation services, hygiene education, and establishing water, environment, and sanitation committees in communities where the project works. This new agreement will provide a framework to implement WADA and to allow the parties to establish a range of policy issues to achieve their shared objectives in Nigeria. The United States is proud to work with Nigeria and its international and private sector partners to give the Nigerian people better access to something all human beings need, safe drinking water.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4.